You guys work with Gary as the captain.
You
mm-hmm.
are quick,
Sandy. I decided when they asked me to come down and talk to you that I would give a talk on something that I think would be important that you could really maybe someday use. I have like two or three careers that are all related, but one of the things that enables me to have my other careers, and that is a career as a musician and as a writer, is that I own my own studio. And I made all the mistakes that anybody can possibly make in starting your own business when I went into the studio business. So what I thought I would do is kind of just try to get all the important points across that I could, so that if you guys ever decide to do your own studio or form a partnership with someone and build one, that maybe I can save you some of the grief that you wouldn't see on the surface having, you know, engineered in some studios, but maybe never sat on the business side of the books of the studio or what have you. So the first thing you got to ask yourself when you're going to buy or start a recording studio is what do you basically sell at a studio? And what would you think it is?
Your knowledge?
Partly, yeah.
Access to equipment.
Yeah.
A recording service?
Service. That's the most important aspect of the business. There are studios all over the country that are equipped like you wouldn't believe. I had two friends they were acquaintances, they weren't close friends, that when I was in school a long time ago in college, they were down at Miami University. I met them down there, and I was playing a club. I'm a musician, as I said. And they both came from wealthy homes. I mean, they were like land wealth, you know, they went way back. So their parents gave them a lot of money to start a studio with. So they went to Chicago and they started a studio that was absolutely equipped to the max. I mean, it had a Neumann console with a cigarette lighter on it from a Rolls Royce. I mean, that's how opulent the place was. It was called Omega Sound. You ever hear of Omega Sound? It burned down.
Yeah. Oh. Oh yeah.
We don't know
business,
but and they hired Dave Purple from Stax Recording when Stax had all their problems, out of Memphis, and I mean they laid that place. They had like $25,000 in shag carpeting in that place, and they didn't make it. So obviously it wasn't the equipment that was the problem. It had something to do, I think, with service, you know. I don't think that those two guys were in touch with what the public needed in the way of being serviced, you know. I think they had the attitude that, well, I'll just build the fanciest studio you can have, and I'll have drinks and dope in the back, and I'll have it just so any national rock group will want to come in and record. Well, national rock groups are the bread and butter of only a handful of recording studios. I mean, it's the group off the street, it's the person that wants to, you know, record themselves for the first time, it's the groups that you may not have an interest in engineering that are going to float that studio that you build or get involved with. So, in the service that you sell, then, you want to be able to service all types of people, and then what is the service entailing that you're going to make money? Well, you sell time, and you sell products. That is, you're going to sell tape. You're going to sell records, maybe, if you decide to. Almost every studio forms some sort of a business relationship with a couple of pressing plants, and they'll handle they'll send out a tape with the instructions on how it should be mastered to sound right, and maybe they'll mark up the cost of the records by whatever percentage the market will bear, 5%, 10%, 15%. And you'll sell cassettes or 8-tracks if you want to get into those. And then the third thing that you can sell in a studio, and this really depends on you as an engineering type or as a creative type, is a creative service. That is, you can sell beyond time yourself as a producer. I mean, there are some groups and some people that come to my studio and they say, you know, Dan, I like to rent the studio, but I've recorded once before, and I know you've recorded extensively. What is your time worth if I hired you to be here and make sure the tracks got done properly? Well, that's a decision you all have to make as you go along in your career, whether you want your signature on a novice's tape or, you know, whether you don't, or maybe you'll want to say, well, I'll, you know, just for X amount of dollars, I'll hang out and make sure it gets done and I'll consult it, but I don't want credit on the record, or whatever. So now you just determine that you're going to sell time and product. Who are you going to sell the service to? Well, obviously the first thing that most recording studios sell, the first clients are the musicians, the rock musicians. There's a world of them, and there's a way you advertise or get your word out that you do a lot of rock. The country musicians, the jazz musicians, the gospel players, the classical, the folk, every aspect of music, experimental. And when you build a studio, it's sometimes good to ask yourself, are you going to have a focal point? Because there are some studios that make it in this country on strictly, you know, servicing one or two types of music. For instance, Nashville. You know, there are studios down there that are, like Clement Sound, I've done some work there, and it's my favorite recording studio I've ever been in. And as far as getting having a control room and the latest up-to-minute stuff, they've got it. And they've got a great track record of hits on country artists, but I don't think they have one rock record out of there. And that's because of the locale. And I think they want to change that, and there's no reason why they couldn't, because their room is flawless, in my opinion. And but they catered in the trade journals and wherever they advertised to, hey, Kenny Rogers cut 9,000 million hits here. And so subsequently, every big country record producer in Nashville knows about Clement Sound and goes there. Then there's the gospel studio, Hilltop Recording, down in Alabama. Strictly gospel, and they make a big amount of money doing gospel. They do rock gospel, but I think it's a fairly religious organization of some sort. Then there are some New York studios that are classically based that do symphony work, and they earn a reputation out. Most of you are going to end up owning a studio or partners in one in a middle American town or mid-sized town. They're going to have to service all these people. So when you gear the place up, you got to kind of be a studio for all seasons, you know, and that has to do with service again, you know. It's hi.
It's late session.
Well, if I could speed myself up, I'd recap everything, but I hope you folks can get it.
Your eyes are red.
Anyway. You should, I think, adopt an attitude that you're going to treat everybody with respect. It's an interesting, there's something to learn, obviously, from everybody in every kind of music, and there's something to, you know, as an engineer, to learn as you record each kind of music, their approach. And if you maintain a positive attitude with everybody that comes through the door in terms of the service, you'll find that they'll in turn relate that experience to their friends in the field or genre of music that they work in. For instance, I did a session with a punk rock band out of Columbus about 2 months ago, and Frank Zappa got the tape, and now the group is en route to New York City to showcase at the CBGB.
What's the name of the group?
It's Kid Cole. Real strange, he had his hair purple when he did a showcase. My engineer did the sound for him. He has a great voice. He really does. He has the talent in terms of having a David Bowie-esque voice, real recordable. But in any event, the point I wanted to make was, since I've recorded him, I have done probably three bands, you know, the same, into the similar genre of music, you know, real either punk rock or new wave or whatever. But the reputation was, hey, they did a good job of it. In the same token, I recorded the Muff Brothers, who have a regional reputation. They did some demo work. I have a small studio at my place, and the result is I get a call from Whitlock and some of the other heavy-duty rock bands. And I attribute this to the fact that bands tell, you know, word spreads, man. How are you treated, basically? It's not even on. There are better equipped studios in Columbus, and I'm sure, you know, that they have their good days and their bad days with people, but it seems to me that I can tell you for a fact that I have musicians come to me and say, well, I went up to this one studio, man, and they were so, like, they just didn't want to talk to me. And if you don't treat people like, you know, their projects are important, believe me, they'll find someone that will, and they'll go there and record. Yeah?
Excuse me. Where did you say your studio was?
Downtown Columbus.
How many tracks?
Called them, it's 8-track. Just an 8, so high, I call it a hyper-equipped 8-track. I have a ton of outboard gear in it. That I know of that are legitimate, there are probably five or six. There's a lot of garage studios and basement studios. But then, I mean, working 16 or 24s, there are at least four or five that I can think of, you know, offhand. Let me move on to who else are you going to sell your service to? Sell to industry, if you're in any kind of a market over 100,000 people. Industry, well, who's that? Well, you get a written piece up on your studio and you send it out to the major corporations in the area because they might have a public relations arm that does a slideshow on, you know, the history of X and X steel company. They go out and they'll shoot slides and they'll come in and record a soundtrack to show with the slides. And that's, you know, they'll pay top dollar to do it right, to have it done right. Film company. There's a whole raft of studios in the United States that are from the real techies, and you know, there's probably some in here, guys that have the patience and the determination and are willing to sweat for hours syncing sound to film. And those engineers make a lot of money. There's a lot of studios in the country, in the major markets, that do that kind of work. There's Motion Picture Sound up in Cleveland, Ohio, and there's CRC Recorders in Chicago to come to my mind immediately. Then there's a raft of them, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer studios, and there's a whole art to that, you know, syncing mag to film. And like, you know, there's a whole world of that. And if you're in a big market, you may consider that aspect. Columbus has one studio that does that kind of work. Then, besides industry, advertising agencies, it's like they'll have a whole handful of clients that might need commercials done. And now that's how my studio started. I serviced the advertising world while I was a full-time musician, and I did an album, and I was, you know, doing a lot of dates. I saved up my money and built a studio, and I put it downtown Columbus to service advertising because I knew that the market, or I suspected the market, would sustain a studio, and it paid the rent. They come in, they cut commercials for chain stores, you know, car dealerships, for banks.
You said you suspected. Is there any way of getting figures, you know, that might have a study, you know?
Well, I was going to get the research, you know, research board out. I went around. I went, you know, I got dressed up. I didn't bother me. I played the game. You know, I went around. I talked to the creative directors briefly. I had a few questions. I'd call them up and I'd say, the secretary, who's the creative director? And I'd call back and I'd ask the crew, I'd have her buzz in, and I'd say, hi, my name's Dan Green. I'd like to come in and talk to you about providing a service for your agency. And you know, you meet some jerks and you meet some people that'll look you in the eyes and say, okay, yeah, we need another studio or we don't. And that's how I went in, that's how I started. And there's a raft of studios in New York City downtown and Chicago downtown that never grow more than 4 tracks and do an enormous business. And they charge 3 times what I charge an hour to record 4 tracks. There's one in Boston, pays its engineers real well, and they do nothing but voiceover commercial work. And there are engineers now that freelance out in Columbus. There's a couple of them that make a real good living to advertising firms. They get a real good reputation with the large agencies, and the agency calls them into New York when they're going to produce a big jingle. They say, this is our engineer, you know. They hire the studio, but we want our engineer to engineer it. And for instance, a good example of that, Billy Sherrill in Nashville sometimes gets calls to do all kinds of strange things. He's got a bunch of gold records under his belt, but he also can mix live sound and stuff and has a reputation for, you know, being really good. And as a freelancer, he goes out to Vegas to run sound for Kenny Rogers. He makes $1,000 a day, plus expenses. So this is from his mind, you know, this is what he told me, so I believe him. Okay, the other people you can sell a service to, of course, are the religious people, the evangelists. The preacher that has his radio show on in 10 counties, you know, and they need tape duplication. You know, occasion, ability. They need a place to record it and to do it right. And especially throughout the country, in the Bible Belt, it's more prevalent. But even in Columbus, you know, I've had not a lot of experience with that, but I've had different evangelists come in and sometimes speak. And that just came in, I don't know from where, you know, from heaven. They called up and I said, yeah, sure, we can do it for you. Then there's the educational, institutional type places. That is like every week in Columbus, there's I don't know how many conventions or seminars, and there's Ohio State University, where information's being passed from people who are more educated to those less educated. Sales meeting. Sometimes you'll get, you know, you can make, there are companies that make a lot of money going around recording on cassette. Now, this may not be in the bag after learning to multi-track record, you may be into music, but they go around and they record seminars and they sell the cassettes on the spot. They have a label printer there, types up the printer. They sell these things. They probably end up buying them in huge quantities, pay 70 cents a cassette or six, sell them for $5. And they make their money that way. I read an article in Newsweek once about a kid who was 19 in Atlanta that really started a huge business that way. And you'll find, you know, buy Psychology Today or almost any magazine, and this has anything to do with education, the back would be a raft of cassettes available in countless subjects. So there's a business and an industry there. I consider that, you know, almost a recording industry. And then there's instructional tapes, like a guy in the community wants to put how to play guitar on tape and sell it. What's to stop them? Children's books on tape. There's now a company putting out great novels on tape to play in your car when you're crossing the country. And there's not that much competition in that field. These are ways of making money when you're trying to build a business or have a recording business. So those are some of the markets to think about, and I'm sure there are others I haven't touched on, one of them being video. You know, a recording studio. Well, why not record video tracks? There are many groups that would pay, you know, to have a video cassette of themselves along with the tape they just cut so their manager can take it to New York and play it. And I know for a fact that in half of the major labels' offices, there's a video player in there somewhere. And it's a pretty hip thing. Some groups have been sold on video cassette. So that is becoming more and more prevalent in the industry, and I think something to think about when you start your studio for as a long-term thing. Well, how do you begin? You know, go ahead.
On the video, do you have them doing tape actual performance and tape what they were doing?
Both ways, maybe. You know, both ways. Maybe have it just like you're on location. You might have an on-location truck. I know that we go on location. I'll lift my studio out. I had it built that way so I can have everything caseable in case I have an important, you know, on location. We'll do it. But why not have a video camera too and add that under the service? Or say, hey, we'll do it in the studio for less while you're recording if you want. Or after you're done with your takes, we'll fake it and we'll shoot just a bunch of, you know, 5 minutes for it just so they can see it. And that's a thought. I mean, I don't have that service in my studio now, but I have a degree in telecommunications, and it's a long-range thing. I've really considered it as a, you know, as a service to be able to provide and to make money with it. Well, so now you know what you're going to sell and who to sell it to, so how the heck do you start to do it? And the first thing you do is, we brushed upon, is research the marketplace. Obviously, if you live in a town that's really small, when I say small, like 5,000, 10,000 people, if you're not near a major populated area, you may be wasting your money. Unless you're going to live in such a remote, pretty, you know, geographical, attractive place where, providing you have a lot of money, you can build another caribou ranch or something that will induce groups that have money or labels to send, you know, people to you. And I wouldn't recommend that unless you have major contacts beforehand in the major music markets. That is, you have a relationship with an agency, a big one like William Morris or ABC Booking or MCA, or with the labels, you've got friends that are actually working somewhere in a major label and would say, hey, yeah, you got a really hip facility, we'll check you out. And you can afford to advertise it in big ads and the big trades. And there's, you know, I'm sure a lot of the studios that are built that way out in the in nowhere like Chicago studio and all, weren't built to make money necessarily so much as to service the groups need. In other words, they could go and record at 3 a.m. if the muse hits them. You know, they feel like, hey, I got it. Now it's time to put it on tape. Versus, let's build something to make, you know, to make the money with. So you determine if there's a need. You go around to the bar, you know, you talk to your friends that are players, you know, and you check out the other studios in town, you listen to what they've done, and you think about it. It's nice to own a studio, but it's no fun to throw away money. You know, I built it at a fairly opportune time. Since then, you know, the Tascam machinery has become so popular that there are thousands of people owning those things. So I think we're heading towards a market where it's going to be the better equipped, you know, you're going to have to out-equip the kid that can afford to do it on his graduation money or something. Now you start thinking, well, okay, there's a need for a studio. What kind of studio do I start with? You know, well, obviously, budget is the bottom line. And you know, you can build with all used equipment, or you can build with all new equipment. You can build a 2-track, a 4-track, a 16, a 24, a 48, or whatever you know you can afford. I think that after you've done your research, should pretty much determine what kind of studio to build. If you've got a marketing scheme for a 24-track studio and the money, then by all means, build it. If you don't, then be conservative about it at first. You know, plan on how you're going to sustain the place, if you're going to work part-time to keep it open at nights and just record at nights on an 8-track. One of the parts of the research that you should get to, too, is where do I put the facility? You know, if there's 4 recording studios on the north end of a town that's got 50 square miles or 40, and there's nothing on the east end, and a lot of people out there, a lot of clubs, and a lot of activity, a lot of music stores or whatever, you might want to put it there because you're accessible, and that has, you know, energy costs keep going up, and it's nice to be able to record close to home. You might think, too, if all the studios are relocated in town, there's nothing in the just outside of town, maybe it'd be nice to have a place where, you know, musicians felt really at home. They could go out in the back and, you know, get loose, whatever, you know, without having to worry about, you know, who they're going to offend. That is a problem. My place, I'm downtown in a downtown office building. So, you know, this is I don't have a personal stand pro or con any kind of drug. But during the business hours, you know, I don't have rock groups in there. You know, if someone starts lighting a joint in the studio in the middle of the day, while the accountants across the hall are walking by, you know, that's not a very hip thing. I mean, it wouldn't be too cool to be busted, you know, in the middle of downtown, only a couple blocks from the police station. So, very convenient, you know. So after hours, buildings locked up, and the weekends, you know, if someone brings beer up there or whatever they bring up there, you know, you might have to think about your policy. Some studios induce, you know, rock musicians that way. You know, I tend to shy away from it simply because I think that it's not worth the risk. So you decide, you pick a location, you've researched, you're going to build a studio. What's the most important thing to think about now? What would you suspect?
Acoustics,
the building. There is where it all begins. You can have the best equipment in the world and cut a lousy sound. And I have tapes from studios all over the place to prove it. And in designing a room, there's a lot of ways to go about it. You can go to the library, and there's probably a handful of books there on acoustics. You can hire or consult a turnkey operation like Nashville Studio Supply, East Lake Audio, Sugarloaf. These companies will charge a lot of money. They're not in the business of building 2-track studios or 4-track studios, but they might build an 8-track, you know, for the right amount of money, or send you the good plans, and it may be worth buying them if you have the square footage.
Could you repeat who you would consult?
Nashville Studio Supply, East Lake Audio. These are big companies. Some of these guys won't sell you plans for a room for less than $5,000, $10,000. But their rooms have cut gold and platinum albums. And that has a lot to do with things. There's a lot you can get on your own just by looking around and reading and researching. When I built my studio, I had some Westlake audio plans that were handed down from studio to studio, I think. And I have a very small facility, but I built it using every ounce of material that they required, you know, that they said worked the best on the walls, you know, sheetrock and Sellotex and sheetrock and Sellotex and whatever. And the slope of the ceilings and the baffling that I did in a small area really can, I'll tell you, it made a huge difference to the sound of that my 8-track versus others that I've heard tapes out of. I have a drum sound that's very competitive.
If you contact one of these consulting firms, would you say, would it be like you have an existing building, you'd have them build, you know,
right.
design inside of that?
Or right.
Just, yeah.
They would come out, they'd fly up. I mean, it's for, you know, when you've got some heavy bucks or at least a decent amount of money. We're not talking $5,000 or $10,000. We're talking upwards of that. And you're ready to do something serious. These guys won't waste your time. In other words, they'll come in and there's two ways they'll contract it usually. One, they'll consult it and just sell you the plan, or just several ways. Two, they'll sell you the plans and direct the building. You hire the labor. Or three, they'll hire their own labor, bring it all up from wherever, and just, you know, take the inside, you know, bare walls, and when they're done, when they leave, they'll have installed everything. Some will just build the rooms and leave. Some will build the rooms and bring in a guy that will clip wires. You know, there's 500 foot of cable, of building cable under the floors in my place, and I have an 8-track. I had a guy come in to wire it, because I have a great engineer who does good soldering work, but I knew someone that did, you know, his work was done, it looked like it was done for NASA. He, you know, heat shrink tubing on all, every wire that goes into place, and it really looks good, and it doesn't break. And, you know, sometimes you think, wow, man, I'll do it myself. And if you're meticulous and you're good, then do it yourself by all means. But if you know for a fact that, you know, you're not the, you know, most adept at wiring or whatever, it's good to hire that stuff out. Because in the long run, a breakdown during a session, which costs you 2 or 3 days to trace a cracked wire or a bad solder somewhere, isn't worth the, you know, the extra $100 you pay to have someone who's really done it before do it. So you might think about that. So you get a list of the materials you're going to need and your labor. And I always say this, always get the best you can possibly afford in any aspect all the way. You know, if you have to cut it down to $5 and $10 for an amp or something, I mean, go to $10. Get a used Crown 300 instead of a, you know, a Sansui 150 or something. I mean, get an amp with a track record that's clean. Get speakers that are clean. I mean, if you're going to get used equipment, you know, buy the big names if you can afford them, if there's any way to afford them. Buy the names that have a track record that have research and development going on all the time. There's nothing wrong with buying used audio. Just be careful about how you buy it. You know, if you can go see the machine and you have a friend who's a good tech and he'll let you put an oscilloscope on it, what's the difference? You know, I would buy a used recorder if I could go in there with an oscilloscope and see the frequency response in every channel. But, you know, that stuff doesn't deteriorate that much. And it's easy to get parts. If it's easy to get parts for, you can always bring it back up to spec. Let's see. So I wanted to give you some estimates on what it might cost to build a studio. I think to build a decent demo studio, that is, using just Tascam equipment and a reasonable amount of mics and mic stands, takes right now, I would say about $12,000 to $15,000 in equipment, and I would say $5,000 to $15,000 in, you know, the way you do your room. So anywhere from, you know, maybe $17,000 to $30,000 to build a small 8-track that's going to be at least a real studio. It's not a huge fortune, but I mean that would be enough to start. 16. I mean, you might start at about 25, or well, it would be more than that. if you went used, because a used 16-track machine runs anywhere from $12,000 to $20,000, and a used console that is service 16s will sell anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000 usually. So a voiceover studio that was just 4 tracks, you could probably build for $15,000. You know, I wouldn't recommend putting in tape on a 4-track in a professional studio. I'd recommend starting out with a 1/2-inch machine though. Okay, so those are some prices. Now, what kind of outboard gear is probably essential for a studio? I mean, that's the question I had to ask myself. And if I would get every piece that my engineer wanted, I would, you know, I would be wearing rags. I mean, too much is not enough for my particular engineer, the guy that works full time at the studio. But you need a limiter, at least one. One compressor, one limiter, because there's always going to be that singer or that instrument that just has a frequency response that will drive the tape machine nuts or you nuts. You know,
either compressor or limiter or both?
Both would be ideal, of course. A compressor, probably 1176 is probably, you know, a Yuri would probably be the most versatile of them.
You have a Keepex, don't you?
I have Keepex in my place. I have a handful of Keepex, but that's for my drum booth, basically, and for voiceover work. It really, you know what Keepex does. Do you know what a Keepex unit does? It's a noise gate. Responds to the volume, that's all, the decibel pressure at the microphone. It turns the track off if there's not a certain amount of pressure at the mic, sound pressure. So the result is it gives a, when you're doing a lot of voiceover work and you got a sibilant announcer who might smoke all the time and has a hoarse rasp when he breathes in, it cuts that out. All you hear is when he speaks and nothing when he doesn't. And it's a good way to have a really clean sound. And using it with a Tascam, it helps a lot to have a little bit of Keepex on the important track.
What are
they about? Oh, about anywhere from, there's new companies making them. Allison Research is the kind that I have, and they ran 3 years ago around $290 for the unit, and a power supply was $100. That's not that much, I mean, for a pro piece of equipment. And you can get any good drum booth, you know, 2 or 3 in the drum booth is great. Because what can happen is you can isolate, you've all been miking drums, Keepex allows you to, you know, to have that, the thud of that bass drum, and not all the all the other drums going off don't leak into that bass drum mic or whatever, and we'll put it on the snare and cut out all the isolate that snare to get it really thick. Keepex also you can use as a keying feature so that you can like put a tone generator on it. Let's say the song's in the key of G. This is done on a lot of records, disco records particularly. They'll put a tone, a low G through it, the song is in G. And they'll put it on the bass drum mic. The only time that the bass drum is heard is when it hits, and then that tone is in there too. And you can mix it in just as much as you want, so that boom, it's real warm, and it gets a real present bass drum sound that way. What else would be important? Well, an echo chamber is important to have. That's what distinguishes you between you and the home studio, the guy that, you know, has his PA head at home for his reverb. You know, get a decent chamber. Start out with a good spring reverb system, a good one, you know. Recommendation? AKG makes a real good one now for about $1,100. It'll suffice to start with. It isn't terrific, but it will suffice.
Springs?
It springs. Orbin Parasound, I haven't heard those much. When used properly, they have a lot of EQ on there, EQ'd right and not overly. The thing about chambers is if you throw a lot of instruments into a chamber at once, you lose the fidelity of the chamber and you start getting that washed out springy sound, you know, that no one likes. But if you have a stereo chamber and you divide out what you're going to throw into it at either side at one time, that provides you with a cleaner sound. And so I'd recommend that you get a good chamber, and I'd recommend that you have at least one heavy-duty microphone sitting around somewhere. At least one microphone that you won't see at Joe's Music and Grill. You know what I mean? A Neumann, a C414 AKG, an RE20, if that's the best you can do, but get one big studio mic. C414B. It's an AKG stereo mic that runs on a power supply that has, you know, that extra amount of absolute fidelity. Because that will make a difference to the average group coming in. When the lead singer, they know how important their vocals are, when that one instrument has got to be done right. Certain microphones, you know, do it right. And you've probably all discovered that a U87 is a good microphone. I mean, it hasn't changed for years. And there's a raft of Shure microphones around and a raft of AKG small mics and Beyer microphones that are good for a lot of purposes. And I recommend that you don't go with just one kind of mic, that you do have a variety of dynamic and condenser microphones. But have one, you know, one sitting somewhere that says professional. And that makes a difference. Now the other stuff that's available in this market is just always expanding are the mixdown toys, the flangers and the digital delay lines and the whatever's that they've come out with now. All these new devices, I haven't heard a third of what's available anymore. I have an acoustic computer made by Delta Lab in my studio now, which I like. I mean, it's probably comparable to a Lexicon machine. It does delays, it flanges. It has its own echo chamber sound, which isn't so hot, but it works all right in a pinch. But it makes a difference with rock groups, particularly. The pop producer wants to come in and he wants to be able to get effects. So as many of those as you can provide, it's instrumental in the amount of sessions you may end up with. I know that it's given me an edge to have, you know, to have a good flanger around and to have a digital delay line and to have a stereo echo chamber. Those things have been, I mean, you can't put a dollar sign on it, but I know that it makes me different from the guy that charges less and has a studio in his basement. You know, so you might think about that when you start. Instruments. When you're deciding, you know, you're going to build a studio, there's a raft of instruments now. Just like with delay lines and things. Now, I don't have much in my studio at the time being. I had a synthesizer, I sold it. But my intention is to get a bigger one. I have a Baldwin piano, you know, in my studio. Good piano, you know, can't get a good enough piano. A lot of groups, a lot of singer-songwriters and demo sessions, a lot of everything requires a piano. So a lot of groups will want you to have a good, well-tuned and tunable piano. I shopped a long time before I bought my piano, and it's going to suffice for the time being. I bought a Baldwin. It must be 40 years old. It's a gorgeous antique. It was in a very good condition. If I had my choice, I'd have a Bösendorfer. You know, I don't have the room, but I'd have one. I'd have a 9-foot one, you know, or a 7-foot one at least. Is there a question? Well, so the other thing you might have, and some studios have, are a set of drums. This really depends on your locale, though, and drummers, you know, are as particular about their sound as guitar players are particular about their sound, but for convenience and setup time, having your own kit can be real helpful. And another thing, you know, which I'm intending to get a good set for my studio, because we do a lot of jingle work. I do a lot of work where I, you know, contract my services to write music for companies and sell that service. That's one of the creative services I market. If I had a drum booth set up all the time, it would save me a lot of time. It's a headache, you know, getting a good drum sound. At Muscle Shoals, they earn their reputation at one of the hottest studios in the country, cutting more hits than some major studios combined. They have a drum booth that's killer. And they must have spent, I don't know how long, to get the drum sound they get out of that one other one booth, at least the old studio they had. I had the pleasure of listening to a track on Atlantic Records that was cut at Muscle Shoals, and we got to throw up the faders one at a time and just, you know, listen to it. And they had a drum sound without EQ on him, it sounded perfect. I mean, it was like when you heard the bass drum, that you saw a bass drum, when you heard the snare hit, it's, you know. So that's an important thing. Okay, so that's all I can tell you about equipment and building it and the money involved. Now, what can you expect to be your cost? You know, some of the things that are going to sneak up on you and stuff. Well, obviously your rent and the taxes. Rent taxes, you've got to consider, you know, what are they going to be? There's, in Ohio, we've got the most unjust tax. It's in a lot of states, but we have personal property tax laws in Ohio. You know what that is? You know, you buy something, and they tax you after you bought it. It's one of the things, it's one of my biggest gripes, that I could pay off a piece of equipment that cost me $8,000 and, you know, pay it off in 3 or 4 years, and then the state is taxing me at a certain percentage to own it, to be in business and use it, which to me is like really, you know, that's something you have to consider. Find out what is the personal property tax rate, or have an accountant that doesn't want to report what you own. I mean, it's up to you. Your phone. Phone in a small town particularly is real important. In any town is real important. My phone has 2 lines on it now. I run a small ad in the Yellow Pages, which does me a little bit of good. I've kept it real small. I don't think it does a whole lot for me to have had a huge ad. But it is a word-of-mouth business. A lot of it is. It's, you know, someone takes your label of your studio and their cassette and they play it at their friend's house and they say, hey, that's a really... And that's what stimulates most of your work. Then so that gets me to advertising. And I haven't really, I'll tell you, something I've never really done is really promoted heavily my studio. It's mostly been word of mouth. Occasionally you can run an ad in a rock rag that's, you know, in the area. Or, you know, get involved with a local radio station in a contest, you know, like this Battle of the Bands or whatever, and offer so much time to get to induce a group to come in and hear your voice and use it. Your utilities, you know, obviously one utility is going to be the major one, electricity. You know. Columbus Southern Electric owns a piece of my studio every month, you know, there's no doubt about it. Fifth expense that I could think of is labor. And that will depend on, you know, how you set up your business. Are you going to be the chief engineer, or are you going to hire somebody? What are the going rates? What is someone willing to work for? And this field, like all others, really varies. There are engineers. I don't know what the top engineers in the country make, but I know that engineers make everywhere from minimum wage, you know, that I've met, to $35 an hour for their time. And I'm sure there are some that make more than that, and some that work for free, you know, depending on their experience. At the experience level, it's that kind of a field. Some of you probably leave here. Some of you wanting to be engineers, you'll apprentice somewhere for nothing, but you'll know that if you get into the heavier places, you'll make good money. If you're going to hire an engineer, this is a real important aspect of your studio and something to think about. He should have a lot of qualities. I mean, I could think of 5 that are probably essential. One, he should have technical facility. He should know a little bit about what goes on inside the gear as well as outside the gear. He should be able to tune your tape machine, make the bias adjustments. Troubleshooting, he should have a little smattering of that, you know, because if you don't, or else you should have a clear understanding that if it breaks, the first thing he does is call you, and then you take care of it. You know, if you can't repair it yourself, you know who to call to have it repaired. You don't want someone who thinks they know maybe something and opening up your $10,000 console and shorting it out and burning up, you know, a bunch of $20 ICs. He should have a decent personality. He should be that type of person that you like personally, number one, that you trust implicitly. You've got to be a trust factor somewhere in there with an engineer. He should have that kind of personality that he can, like, bend with the times, you know. If he's got a country group in there, he can, you know, can provide them with the personality that they'll need. I mean, the engineer has to really be a good public relations person. After all, the group that leaves that place is going to remember their sound, but they're going to remember who they work with. And if you hire a guy that can't stand some kind of music, and you're recording that kind of music, you better believe it, it's going to get back to you somehow, some way. That group's going to come up to your desk at the end of the day or whenever they're going to settle a bill, and they're going to let you have it. I can't work with this guy. I mean, he was impossible. You gotta have a willingness. You gotta love his craft. You better get a guy that's that's a freak at it. You know, I think my engineer may be way already gone. I mean, he loves sound. He built his own stereo system. You know, he's one of those types. But he, if I say we got a session that's gonna last until midnight tonight, he never says, "Oh man, I." There are times he has to turn down work, but he'll work hard. If the project is going well for some band, and he knows that, and they say, "Hey, can we work into the late hours?" Most of the time, he'll say, "Yeah." He rarely kills a session unless it, sees it's getting nowhere and the money's not worth his, suffering is, whatever. It's got to be objective. Guy's got to be objective about things, and that's in two areas. One, in his taste, like I've already discussed, got to be objective. Got to be able to have a feel for just how much he can get out of a client in terms of their creativity, not their money. That will come out of just him being kind to them and helping them along. The clock will run, but if he encourages them to get a good take, and you make that decision as an engineer, how long after one song goes down does it really take this act to get it down on tape? And you'll see that there's a certain level of proficiency, and the longer you engineer and the more people you're sitting behind that console recording, the more attuned you become to their level of, competence as recording musicians. And, he's got to kind of know when to say, hey, let's all just take five and have a Coke or something, after a couple hours of grueling. And finally, the last thing, I think, creativity. And you can take mediocrity and make it into something good, and you can make something great lousy. And the engineer does it. And what's happening in the field of music more and more, and I think this is you're going to find true in your own career. Engineers are going to start getting production points on record albums, and rightfully so, because the engineer contributes a lot to the way things sound. So if you've got a good engineer, who's got a creative head on his shoulders, has the ability to come up with the effect, the guitar player says, "There's just something wrong, man. I don't know what it is. Not a fat enough sound." My engineer goes and says, "Well, I'll tell you what. Let's run a speaker over here, and let's run an ambient mic in this room over here. And let's run this here, and then let's put it through this machine. Let's take it dry. Let me put this Y plug here and run you straight into the board, and then we'll have these three other mics out in the studio." And the guy plays and he listens on the speaker and he says, "That's just what I was thinking." I mean, I've had it happen to me a lot where someone says, "I never thought I could get a sound like that out of a place that's, a small 8-track. I thought I had to pay twice as much." And I attribute that to experience. My engineer was a live mixing engineer for 2 years, and I did a lot of varied stuff. I thought I would take a break right here and answer any questions, and maybe we could all take, I'm supposed to speak, I think, for another 30 minutes. If we took 10 minutes or something, I'll speak 15 minutes on a day in the life of the studio and things that happen, and then I'll take any more questions.
So getting back to the cost of running the studio, the phone and advertising, utilities and labor and stuff, if you keep, those are all tax deductible at the end of the year, correct?
Yeah, some percentage of that.
Percentage. As long as it's related to the business.
But the years I keep buying stuff, But I started out with a modest amount, probably $12,000, and then struggled. I had to go to the bank within 3 months and borrow a lot.
Can you talk a little bit about getting a small business loan and how you want to
forget it?
What kind of collateral?
I can tell you, forget it. I got a great credit rating, and I couldn't get a loan.
Well, right now, you're looking at when prime hit 20%.
Yeah, it's time to go home.
That's right. It's time to just.
Well, they said times are better now because the federal. They lifted all those things, so now Visa's going to let out more credit cards when they said it's going to be easier to get credit.
Isn't there a government agency, like a small business administration?
I've never approached them, I've never approached the small business. I think the trouble with that, and someone advised me, was since the studio doesn't really employ that many people, they're not really interested in helping you so much. They like to help the small business as the guy that has, a small assembly plant somewhere that, they got 20 guys on the in the community they can help out at once. But that may be different in every market. I went to the bank, you know, after I'd been in business for, I'd say, 9 months. And I took a small loan, and then I went again, I took a bigger loan like 6 months later. But I didn't, even on that small one, it was just a few thousand bucks, I needed a co-signature. Someone in my family had to sign with me. And it wasn't, you know, he never had to make a payment for me. And I'll tell you, I've noticed that even this year, I went to get a commercial loan like for 90 days this year, just because it was easier for me cash flow-wise to pick up on some equipment if I had the cash in hand. Man, that... I never went through so much hell. I tell you, I was really irritated because it may be that I don't wear a business suit downtown, but I had been doing business at that bank for 5 years and paid back a lot of loans. And they hassled me over $5,000, and I don't think in the world of that. In the world, I mean, they make that for car loans, man, to guys that
more,
are
more
anymore. Cars are $8,000 or $9,000 or anymore, and I couldn't believe it.
And one problem too is they look at you, you know, not Ellen in a 3-piece suit. I was asking for a big chunk of money though, and I went through on my whole background. I had charts and everything, you know. And this is how much we can make the first year. This is projected over, and then, you know, did the whole thing, did a whole big research bit. I spent a whole summer doing that, and the guy gave me one word reply. No. Got it, walked out of the room. I just sat there and I waited for him afterwards, you know, and put sugar in.
I mean, they're real.
They can be tight,
you
know. Of course, when you say recording studio, they figure out all.
Uh oh, musicians, man.
Yeah.
Mom, you know, forget it.
Do a lot of the companies that buy your gear coming up with your consoles, instruments, do they offer like time payments also? Because like your console, you're talking, you know, $15,000 for a piece of finance.
TAC got something, they said.
TAC did that for a while. That went out, that was Finance of America. I think that went out.
Yeah, they went back.
Yeah,
they stopped that.
Oh, yeah. Look for that.
It worked very well.
Once you get your studio started, do you have the ability to avoid the retailers and go directly to the factory? Do you have to have a tax number or something?
Yeah, get a vendor's license in the community and sell your stuff, you know. You only pay tax on it. You charge tax to your clients and you don't pay tax when you buy it. Tape and boxes. And you know, you'll pick up your suppliers. That's a question in the back.
I remember talking before that all my other toys were nothing. And I was wondering if you could tell me what the franchise.
Your own school franchise?
Yeah, exclusive.
Exclusive.
Franchise in your own city. And what they would do, you have to come up with the first $5,000.
Uh-huh.
And they would finance you up to what equipment you want. It was like a big warehouse. They had all this equipment in it.
No kidding.
So if you call them up, I got to book it home. And call them up, they may fly you out, you know, to where they're at, they'll sign you up, everything. You just have to have a certain amount of experience in business, you know. And from there, they take you in, you know, you have to pay something like 3%, you know, interest.
Sounds really cheap to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Give me that address.
Yours? Well, I would, you know, I would definitely look into that. I would definitely call the Better Business Bureau before you committed any money up front to anybody like that. Because I'll tell you, one experience in business that you can't ever learn enough times is there are very, very, very few situations in life and in business, and I don't mean to be too philosophical or heavy-handed here, but there's nothing, something for nothing does not exist in the world, and we're all human beings, and we all, if you provide people with something, you will get something in return. It's just the law of nature, and it's true in business. People that are telling you they're going to make you millionaires, come in, it's like groups coming to me and saying, Dan, we got the greatest songs, man, if you just record us, I mean, we're going to get a record deal. I mean, it's sad, man. Maybe some of these people would. If I could afford to risk it with some of my friends, I will. I'd do it. You might have your own project. There's a couple of people I would produce in my community at my expense. But, I mean, I'd be out of business if I took on everybody who thought that they were the next Led Zeppelin, you know.
As far as, you know, like creative stuff that you can sell out of your studio, have you ever thought about making yourself do, like, a production, 80 single months? There was an article, I think, that was recorded, 78, I forgot which year, which month. But it's about studios in California, small studios, and they rent, like, the L.A. area, and they do full production. They even do, you know, like, do everything from on location. They do video on stuff like that. It's a great silo. Matter of fact, that's what they live on.
There are studios, that, you know, these songwriters festivals? You get all let's say your band builds a studio. So you run an ad in the local papers or somewhere. Your song's demoed for X amount of money. And there are guys that get, they build up their studio chops that way. They provide a service for some that they do a good job, and they can, you know, some of them sell it really cheap, and I imagine they're just doing it to make their equipment payments. Some of them are doing it to make a few bucks. They charge anywhere from, you know, 30 to 150 a song, depending on how many instruments, how many singers, or what have you. I mean, there's a lot of ways to sell creativity. Obviously, you know, I administrate a jingle company out of my studio now, which does work all over the country by through reputation and marketing. And it's only been going on, I've been doing jingles off and on for, you know, several years, but I really formalized it in the last 6 months. And that arm of my studio is probably going to eventually mean a lot to me. But if, you know, once again, though, I found Al-Qaeda resistance in Columbus, my own city. I mean, I get work for these big agencies, but they'd rather go to Nashville and spend 10 times as much, but have their clients wined and dined in Music Town USA. So I fight that, so I've gone after, I've marketed it in the small markets and stuff, and I'm trying. It's just, you know, you want me to just finish up here? Okay. Was there any other questions too before I go? Now that is a real possibility, leasing equipment. For 24th track, if you've got an established business, I mean, that's a move I could do eventually in my studio. But it's expensive. I mean, you don't want to lease anything that's not going to be, you know, really extra good, right? Now, it saves you a headache in repairs and maintenance if you get a leasing contract that they service it. But I'm not too familiar with all the deals offered, but let's face it, an MCI 24-track machine is about $35,000 to $38,000 now. That's a lot of money for a tape recorder. You know, for one piece of gear, and there's a lot that integrates into that, it might be worth it to pay $300 to $400 a month if you know you're going to book that thing out at $75 an hour and know that you're going to be able to keep it booked for $100 an hour, at least some, you know, at least enough to make that payment, you know, easily every month.
Well, another thing about buying gear is looking for new things coming on the market, especially if it's a big product like Neotech board. When they first came out, they were offering incredible deals just to get their boards someplace where people could hear them.
And right now, I mean, I think in the electronics industry, maybe not so much, maybe the only helpful industry in the United States. But there, you know, the recession hits anybody, and when you have cash on hand, this type of economy, you can pick up deals. There's always deals. Just remember that. And there are audio consultants in New York that do nothing but deal in used equipment. And there are journals out now, nothing but used equipment. And I don't see, like I said, if you can afford to buy a new one, get the warranty, get it. If you can't find the egghead tech, or if you're one yourself, you know what I mean? Someone that really you can troubleshoot real easily. There's nothing wrong with, you know, buying a used piece of gear if it's a name brand. It can save you a lot of money, and no one will know the difference unless, I mean, let's face it, the tape machine usually sits in one place in a big studio. It doesn't get kicked or scratched up. The only damage that can be done to it is head wear or transport wear. You know, if the motor's not good, you get wild and flutter, well, you're shot. But, you know, I think it's always best. Like, my next decision will be, well, I'm going to go 16 or 24, and am I going to go 1-inch Tascam, or am I going to go 2-inch used? And Tascam's running all this hype about, well, spend $7,500 or $8,000 or whatever on this instead of 10 or 12 or 14 on it. And personally, I would rather go with a 2-inch tape machine for for the transport, the electronics, for the, you know, and I'm talking like an MCI or an M79 or an Ampex, you know, but something within, you know, a few years old. I would prefer, you know, something just out of warranty from one of these major companies to a Tascam, because I know experience from having a 80-8 and owning a mixdown machine cost me more than my 8-track. I have an M79 3M mixdown machine with a, it has select take on it. That thing is a workhorse. I mean, 5 years I've had $300 in repairs. In 5 years. And it still cuts. I mean, I can't trace it. There's a frequency response on that thing is incredible. And that Tascam and the punch-in facility on it, now that, it's good to learn on it because 50% of the studios in the United States are Tascam studios right now. So it's a popular piece of equipment. And I found that by having a lot of good outboard gear around it and a lot of good mics, which I've bought and sweated to get, makes it, I mean, it'll sound great. I have DBX on it. But, you know, if I could have a 2-inch machine next, that's what I'd need for.
In repairing things, I think you're at your board of things. Do you have a lot of difficulty getting them repaired?
No. Not anymore. I mean, you know, Columbus is kind of middle America, though. You got a Bell and Howell school there. I mean, there's a lot of guys running around with oscilloscopes and soldering irons. And, you know, just get a ski mat and get a guy across an engineer. And I mean, there's a handful of guys in this working area that are really good. I trust them.
You said you used DBX?
I use DX.
Do you think it's worth the buck?
On the 80-8, I think it is. The one that comes with it seems to make a difference to my ears. I don't think it's worth it on the big machines. I'd rather cut at 30 IPS 2-inch tape. You know, I think that makes as clean a sound as having Dolby or DBX. This is my experience in big studios where I've been doing a lot of big production work. And I've always told them just cut it without the DBX on, without the Dolby. Is that it?
Okay. I didn't see it here. The air code is different.
Right.
Okay, what good would it be if you like the DBX speaker? I hear it. What good would it be just a cleaner sound than this guy?
Well, it's cleaner all the way, you know. It's cleaner when you mix down, basically. But you gotta have it to decode what you, you know, you gotta have it both ways. If you don't want to record a DX, and then it'll give you, believe me, you play a tape through my machine, someone brings in a tape that wasn't, you didn't have a DBX unit on it, and it sounds like it's been, you know, it's pumping, it's like limited and sounds strange. So it's a good thing to have on an 80-8, I think, if that's what you're going to start with, or an Otari, if you can buy an outboard DBX unit, which ones they make. Worth having a circuit. But if you've got a 2-inch machine, it'll spin 30 inches a second for your critical mastering work. I don't think tape should get in the way. I'll tell you, so much has to do with how well you guys learn how to mic in this room. So much. Miking has a hell of a lot to do with it. What kind of mic you use, and those decisions are critical, man, for what it sounds like on tape. In the room. The room sounds lousy, I don't care what kind of mic you got on the person. It'll keep, you know, if the room is boxy, it'll always sound like this, no matter what. It's almost impossible to get rid of the weight of wave reflection. So, well, I wanted to get through this, I'll go real fast now. When I get up, and this, you don't need to take this on. You know, what are my hours? Well, studio owner's hours they're not fixed, you know. They're not fixed. But I have my phone answered 9 to 5 every day. In fact, 9 to 7. I have a service that takes it for 2 hours at night if I'm not there. The phone is your link to the public. And a lot of musicians, you know, work day gigs, they come home at night and they want to call you. So if you've been there all day doing advertising work and go home, you might be missing session, so I try to have the phone, you know, covered. Speaking of the phone, that's basically what, as a studio owner, what I do when I'm not in creative, when I don't have a project. right now I stay pretty busy with my own music interests and jingle interests, you know, writing lyrics or writing a jingle for somebody. I seem to always have something. I'm going to Los Angeles next week for publishing contracts that I'm negotiating, and I'm going out on some songs stuff. But in the meantime, I get phone calls. What are they? What kind of equipment do you have? Who, you know? And one of the things to always try to do, if you have a facility you're proud of, is get the people down there. You know, tell them, why don't you come on down? We're free. You know, have your schedule book near you. You know, come on down on whatever days a week you want to make a day, or doesn't have to be a formal day, but time that's convenient for them in a van or whatever, to come and see the place and listen to tape. See what the facility looks like. I've had groups say, man, this is a small studio, but boy, what a sound. I could dig working in here, you know. And I feel at home in the place, and they feel confident in what they hear. They can't believe it. You know? I'd say it's 460 speakers. I've got a drum booth, I have a small control room, I got an area with the panel in it. And I've got two little closet areas to put guitar pieces right in there. I got it set up with a window so that, you know, a four-piece or five-piece can work real tight to each other. And there's plenty of isolation with the drum booth. I put like 3 tons of sand under the floor, separated the walls from the floor. I did it, you know, I built, like I said, I built it. If Westlake had to work in small quarters, that's what they'd have done, you know, pretty much. And it really made a difference.
Any floating walls?
What?
You got the floating walls.
Yeah, my floors have an inch between them and the walls.
Use industrial rubber?
I used, the design I had, we laid 2x4s and filled between the 2x4s with sand. We put down plywood, 3/4 plywood, a sheet of Sellotex, which absorbs sound, and then a sheet of particle board, 3/4 particle. My floor is like this thick, and it separates, you know, no floor touches a wall. So the result is vibrations don't transfer into the control room. My drum booth is right up to the control room on one side, but we get a real good isolated drum sound. And, what else happens in a typical day? I wanted to keep moving on. There might be a breakdown. I got to think on my feet. I've learned who I can rent from, where I can take things to for quick repair, who I can, you know, count on usually to do the best job. That doesn't happen all the time. If a regular maintenance program in your studio will really help you too. In other words, have that engineer at least once every 2 or 3 weeks, you know, demagnetize everything. I mean, all your copying equipment. Because I didn't even get into that, which you're going to need. You're going to need some, obviously, good mixed-down equipment, 2-track, quarter-track, cassette machine, at least one of all those. He's got to, you know, should go over those. Then there'll be a call, how much does it cost to get 500 albums made, how much does it cost to make a 45, how much does it cost to... Yeah, this doesn't happen every day, but it happens. And you have to have those answers offhand and have a policy that you set, so that you can quote it quickly and efficiently, and they can leave the phone knowing what it's going to cost to work through you. I try to avoid these price wars, you know, with other studios. It doesn't pay. It really doesn't. It's not worth it. There's a certain factor in life, and you'll all find your own, where it just isn't worth it to try to make X amount of dollars for the amount of aggravation. There's an aggravation factor in certain parts of any business. In the recording business, you're going to find it probably in when are my albums going to get here? You have no control. It's one situation I have no control over. I sent them to a good pressing plant, and the plant's backed up doing work for Columbia Records in maybe 7 weeks. And so what I've done recently at that, I sent a lot of groups straight to the plant, gave them the forms and said, here, I didn't mark them up a dime. Make it, you negotiate, you know, you take their rates and get my rates, and they deal direct, and not that. That to me was worth leaving that much money behind, you know, because I didn't want it, and I want the group to come back to record with me, and I wanted, you know, not to be aggravated, okay? It's important to book and see the facility, or to book time. Maybe take copies or something. As a studio owner, I try, you know, sometimes I have to pick up the slack. If the engineer is busy and someone needs something, you know, I have copying equipment available somewhere in the place to do it for them. Sometimes, you know, someone comes in to make a tape copy in the public and they say, wow, I didn't know this place was here, and Next thing you know, they're there. If not that week, I had a guy come in and copy three cassettes. He just moved into town from Oregon. 6 months later, he cut a session. But, you know, I think it had a lot to do with the fact that he came in and he got something done quick and he met me and he saw the way. I greet and talk with the day's clients, the advertising people. I shoot the breeze with them for a few minutes if they're there. It's good public relations. It's part of my job, I think. And then the last part of my day is spending creative production. A lot of it's going on right now at my studio. I'll probably be there this evening, chances are, because of what I got. You know, I'm presenting a lot of stuff in Los Angeles. And that also spec work. You know, when I think I might have a jingle I might sell or some concept, I might do it at night on my own time. So that's about what a day in the life of mine is. It's not a hassle day. Sometimes it can be. You know, because of the, you know, once I phase out of doing any engineering myself, I got a lot of time on my hands. But like I said, I do creative work and that takes the slack. Well, what are you facing the way of competition? There's over 2,000 studios now, to my knowledge, in the United States. I got this out of Pro Sound News about 6 months ago. 50% are 8 tracks, 25% are 4 tracks, and 25% are 16 and above. And the move in the country right now is towards more tracks. A lot of these studios that start in the basement are moving up to heavier tape equipment. And the final thing I wanted to tell you is that people will always be glad to pay for quality. Just remember that. I mean, any of us are. It just stands to reason. So when you start, I mean, work out the parameters of what you can make and live with and then compete at that price. But if you do a job well, people will come back, you'll earn a reputation, and that's what it's all about. The end.